This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. So go ahead with your question.
My question is whether science can prove the existence of God. And the difficulty is that if you answer yes, there's a problem about faith, because you can then produce a proof. And if you answer no, that then you would expect science to close all the gaps, because a gap remaining would count as proof of God's existence.
Yeah, maybe one way to address that is to look at all the words that are translated into the English as faith from the Bible. There are three from the Hebrew and one from the Greek. But what's interesting is they all have their base definition, acting upon established truth. So as a Christian, we do not have faith unless we take some steps to establish what is true, but neither do we have faith if we don't act on what we know to be true. And therefore, that's completely consistent with scientists establishing the existence of God from evidence. But in terms of your question, can science prove the existence of God? Science can't prove anything in an absolute sense. What it does do is establish that certain things are correct to a certain degree of probability. And the more research we can perform, then the more secure that probability can become. But I would suggest that science can easily prove the existence of God to a higher degree of probability than it can prove the existence of any one of us in this room.
I'd just like to make two comments on this. Firstly, my axiom is Paul's statement that the universe gives evidence of two things in Romans 1, that there is a God and that God is powerful. So there are limitations, but that there is evidence. But I notice that Paul is very careful. He does not use the Greek word for proof. He says it is perceived. And from that perspective, I think what we are doing is educating people's perception by giving them evidence. Faith, as Hugh has pointed out, throughout the New Testament, is based on evidence. Paul at Athens gave the evidence of the resurrection as a basis for all people, not just for believers. The second point I'd like to make is that because of dear old Kant, and apologies to those of you who come from his part of the world, there is in many scientists' minds a notion that somehow knowledge and faith are mutually exclusive concepts. The famous statement of Kant, "I eschew knowledge to make room for faith," is simply false. Let me illustrate that to you. Here is a young girl. She knows from her education that hard drugs are very dangerous. She knows that. She comes to a party and there's wild music, and one of her friends says, "Well, look, why don't you try this LSD? Don't you see everybody's having fun?" She knows that it can damage her brain. But her knowledge doesn't mean that she automatically trusts the knowledge. And so she takes it. And I think it's simply false. It's most unfortunate that Kant said that, because one of the major difficulties with my colleagues in Oxford is to get across this notion that at certain levels that the faith that's demanded of them in responding to God, at the first level at least, is no different from the faith that's demanded of them in responding to evidence in any other field. But Kant has been responsible for pushing a dichotomy into people's thinking that is very difficult to resolve.
Okay. No, Ruth wants to say something.
Yeah. I think that's the most important question in scientific apologetics, because if we don't understand what we mean when we say this, we're going to give off the wrong signals. And that, I think, gets people into trouble. And we probably all know people who've got into trouble by thinking this kind of thing in the wrong way.
Do you mean that just Do you mean, Ruth, that people think that that science proves it? Is that the point you're making? That science proves the existence of God? I think we have on
Yeah, that's a, and that's I'm realizing a really difficult question to ask, because if we say science proves God, science is always a working theory. So if we put our, if I put my faith in a working theory, I'm in big trouble. And but then on the other hand, you say, I think the interesting thing is thinking, well, if we do manage to explain everything in supposedly a naturalistic sense, where do we get to? That's something I'm not sure I understand completely at the moment. I think the controversial thing that John said in his talk that made me kind of go, I agreed with everything he said apart from two things which I really want to go away and think about, which was that can we presume that creation is a backwards extrapolation of providence, which is basically is an interesting question for a biologist, which I need to go away and think about. And the other one was that each is similar, that each step in creation starts with the word of God. It didn't happen in a closed system. And that's a difficult thing to argue about, and I think could argue about it for a long time. I'm talking too long.
No, not at all. I mean, I think your two questions to me are massively important. And what I'd say about them is, the short answer is, what I would expect from the Genesis account is that for the most part, we may well get an explanation in terms of simple cause and effect that doesn't involve intelligence, but it seems to me the Bible indicates that there is a limited number, not just one creative act. You see, from the physicist's point of view, they have no difficulty in agreeing that there was a singularity when space-time came into existence. The biologists have more difficulty, I can see that, but the physicists don't have a difficulty. They say there was a time, or working backwards leads us to postulate a singularity where the laws of physics break down. Now, what I would say is, if I'm right in my understanding of Scripture, then I would expect that there's a very limited number of areas, and one of them's the origin of life, where the attempt to explain it solely with in-system cause and effect terms is very likely to break down. But I would come in over and above that to take up your first question to me, and I would say about it is this: all the time, we must bear in mind that there is a distinction between an explanation in terms of mechanism and an explanation in terms of agency. And however exhaustive the explanation in terms of mechanism is, that doesn't of itself rule out agency. The trouble with that is that my non-Christian biological friends come back at that and say, no way can we accept the notion of a God who sort of controls evolution, for example, macroevolution, in such a way that he's abolished all traces of himself. Don't you see that's evidence for the fact that there is no God? And I think we have to deal with that as well. It is subtle, and we do have to do a lot more work on it not to send the wrong signals. I mean, I agree with you that it's so important not to send the wrong signals.
It's meant by agents. Can you elaborate about it? Maybe for you and for English-speaking people, it's obvious, but
if you say mechanisms and agency, what's the difference? Can you elaborate more?
Let me explain with a simple illustration. I lift my arm. Okay? You could give a description of what's happening in here in terms of electrons and electrochemical interchanges, synapses, and so on, in terms of biochemistry, physiology, and everything else. And at the scientific level, it would be complete. But there's another explanation. I lift my arm to get the book off the shelf. It's I lifting the arm. There's an agent, agens, me. That's all we're saying. It's the difference between me lifting my arm. That's one description. The other description is the scientific description of what happens. That's the point I'm making. Okay? Does that make better sense?
the muscles are not agency in this case? The
not, no, 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 not in the technical sense. Agency and mechanism are, well...
Can you use another word? For
yeah, of course I can. Person involvement.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Or source. Source.
Yes.
The source of the thing. For instance, Ruth can also comment further in a minute, but the... When we look at the Romans passage, we understand that people are actively suppressing a perception that's there. I think we need to remember that in apologetics. People are actively and responsibly before God suppressing an awareness that is there. And issues of evolution or intelligent design or intervention aside, I would be very troubled if when we look at the molecular machinery in a cell, we don't allow it to contribute to that perception that there is a God of immense power, wisdom, who planned this whole thing. However the mechanism works out, is how I understand what John is saying, however the methodology God used, to not see God when you look at that molecular machinery seems to me to be a mistake. And sometimes when I hear theistic evolutionists discuss the issue, I feel like somehow they want to help people rule out that perception. Could you comment on that, Ruth?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the best way to articulate this. And I think I'm always going back to the cosmological argument because... this is something that a lot of theistic evolutionists do accept. So I'm trying to think why is there this difference between these two kinds of argument? And what I don't want anyone to take away from me is the fact that a grand picture of what God has done for me is a world that is coherent and that I can understand and that that works according to its own laws. Now, we see that in astronomy, and we see everything working according to its own laws, although the fine-tuning is there, and that's something that we have to explain, but I don't want anyone to take away from me the fact that we know very little about the origins of life, and we know very little about the origins of cellular life, but I don't want anyone to take away from me the fact that I can go in the lab and have a jolly good look about how that came about and be able to sit back and go, that's amazing, look at what God did. There's a really find it. And making a distinction between that and saying, where is the cause of this is a different question.
Okay. So could I follow up on that question? It's a brief additional question. So when Jesus turns water, when the story says that Jesus turns water into wine at the wedding, does that trouble you?
No, because I recognize that as a miracle, that Jesus did. I mean, the question of miracles is...
But from
am
a physicist...
Am I getting myself into trouble here? I mean, the question of miracles is different to me.
Well, it does to me, because I'm a physicist.
Yeah.
And there's no carbon in that water.
Yeah.
For hydrocarbons. So I'm looking at a creative miracle, a discontinuity
yes.
in the laws of nature by the action of God. So whether the biologist is troubled or not, the physicist is troubled. Because if I try to do it, I kill everybody in the room with neutrons. let's take another question, okay? Let's take a question from Rob now.
Bruce said she answered.
Stephen wanted to add something.
Oh, okay. Let's Stephen add that, and then Rob will ask this question.
Well, it's just really a comment on say, the sort of Van Til sort of theistic evolution position, where he adopts this idea of the functional integrity of creation. My sort of question with that is how does he know that is how the world was made? Because it makes a sort of God of the gaps argument, not so much an argument as an axiom, that axiomatically there are no gaps. Hence, I don't see how he could recognize when there was a gap, even if there was one. You know, no amount of evidence, it seems to me, could convince him there was a gap, because axiomatically for him there can't be, because God's made the world in a different way. But I don't understand how he knows that that is how God has made the world. So to me, the only way we can find out is by looking at it. And if the scientific evidence points towards, if you like, a gap, then it seems to me we follow the evidence. That's the way I would approach it.
I think I'm agreeing with John here. In principle, that leaves a lot of unpacking, that we're talking about the difference between good gaps and bad gaps. The good gaps for me in the cosmological argument are the fine-tuning elements, and but in a description of the universe, from a scientific point of view, they're not really gaps.
If I could just add a little bit, the problem is the situation is messy. And it's messy for this reason. That's perhaps a very bad word for a Christian to use, but it's the issue, the functional integrity issue. I can understand people wanting it to be that way. The difficulty is, it seems to me, that the miracle that Richard has mentioned, and above all the resurrection of Christ, and even beyond that, the incarnation, we cannot just say these are distinct, these are part of salvation history. They are part of the history of the cosmos. And just as the resurrection of Christ is not to be explained by physical processes going on in the grave 5 minutes before it happened, it is a singularity which is accessible by the normal canons of historical research. What I'm claiming, I think, Ruth, is this, that we have a limited number, and I would stress that. I'm absolutely with you in not wanting anything to take away from me the massive big thing, and that is that the heavens declare the glory of God. The whole show is evidence of it. Or away from the biologist who discovers the working of biochemical pathways, the DNA code and so on, just being amazed at the sheer ingenuity of God, however it came to be. That's one side, and it's important. But it seems to me that just as history is punctuated for the Christian by certain space-time discontinuities, we might have to open ourselves to the possibility that the beginning is not just to be shoved off to the physicist as a singularity when the space-time continuum erupted because God caused it, but that there is, and I repeat, a limited number of places indicated in Genesis 1 where God speaks. There is a discontinuity. So that I would expect then that our sciences, if they're not prepared for that discontinuity, will run into the sand. If they're not prepared to take on board the possibility, that intelligent origin. But that will involve a good gap. Just as if you extrapolate the origin of this nature paper backwards in time, you will come to a discontinuity that ends in human intelligence. You can look at it as paper. It's a physical constitution. You can trace it backwards to an automatic printing machine in a factory. But in the end, you will come up to intelligence. Now, tidy a view of the universe would be, push that right back to the beginning, which is deism, actually.
We got to move on to another question.
Sorry.
Can I just say one last thing? So what you're doing, you've moved into a different sense of arguing. You're predicting now. So you're making a prediction that in 50 years' time we will find this singularity, which is a very significant thing to do. And that's...
I think the last 50 years of origin of life research are giving a phenomenal cumulative argument.
It's a singularity.
That's the end of this particular question. I think we've exhibited the different questions associated with this question. Go ahead, Rob. Yeah,
thank you. I'm just a simple engineer, and because we're not very bright, engineers tend to think in very simple models. And I would like to propose a simple model and ask you if you would demolish it for me. This model for me seems to reconcile evolution with Genesis, with the fall. And I would, perhaps you could, I think it would be easiest if I use the scratch okay. pad, may I?
That's fine.
If I put time on an axis up here, and if this, I'd like to draw a line which represents the entire population of some pre-hominid that is sufficiently pre-hominid that none of us would believe that it's human. So that it's, it has maybe some sense of aesthetic understanding, but not enough that we would say that it's human. So Darwin's theory of evolution would say that at some stage one of these, one of the members of this population would give birth to a young that had some mutation that might be might fit it better for its environment, and therefore that. Mutation would spread into the population, and that gene would generate a variant. Darwin's very Darwin doesn't care whether we call them variants or whether we call them species. That would then become the whole of that population. That can happen again. Members of the population might produce a mutant offspring, which again would be sufficiently well suited that it would then pass into the whole of the population. This may mean that these new variants or species, call them what you want, become more intelligent, become closer approximation to humans. Darwin would say that wouldn't necessarily be the case. He would just say that that there is no upward movement, no upward striving. There's no direction to evolution. But there is a mechanism here for God, if he wanted to move this pre-hominid population towards a human, towards the state of being human. And at some stage, it's a judgment call, but at some stage you could say that this population is sufficiently human to understand that there is such a thing as sin. And so God could draw a line and say, that variant which is starting there, I would say, is human. And they can now understand that these things that they do, if they do them, are sinful. And therefore, we will. Therefore, that population, that new population, starting from what we might call Adam and Eve, that couple there, could be the new human population. And the rest of these. I want to call them beings. Yeah, beings, which have become extinct, are not human. They don't understand, and God will deal with them however he sees fit. But the members of this population, and that's us, he has given us the law there, and we are now sinning and not living in accordance with his laws. And that sort of model seems to me to reconcile evolution with an old Earth. I'm afraid I can't make it reconcile with a young Earth, but with the fall and Genesis 1-3. Could you knock that down for me, please, if it's not right?
Yeah. 8 years ago, we took on this very problem at Reasons to Believe, and we pulled together 15 research evolutionary biologists from a number of institutions in the California area. California Institute of Technology, University of Southern California, University of California, San Diego, Santa Barbara, UCLA, San Diego, and Riverside. And we also brought together two physicists, a mathematician, and myself. And our project was to try to take the Darwinian principles of evolutionary advance, natural selection and mutations, and see if we could build a mathematical model for speciation. Whereas here we got the mechanisms. Can these mechanisms produce the observed results in the period of time that is allotted? And the problem is this, is that you have mutations that produce beneficial results for the population, but you also have deleterious mutations in that population, and the best that we see biologically is a ratio of 10,000 to 1. Sometimes it's as bad as 10 million to 1, depending on the species. Then the physicists got involved, and I got involved to make the point there's an additional challenge, namely that as these mutations take place, we have the physical environment changing. The sun doesn't remain the same. The earth doesn't remain the same. The crust doesn't remain the same. And so the challenge each species faces is to be able to pick up on the beneficial mutation so that they can change significantly enough before they're driven to extinction by changes in the physical environment or from the deleterious mutations. Well, it took us about 2.5 years to come up with some meaningful results. But the results that we did come up with were that a species would go extinct before it would evolve into something distinctly different unless its population exceeded 1 quadrillion individuals, unless its body size was less than 1 centimeter in the average, if its generation time was less than 3 months, number of progeny per adult greater than 10,000. We came up with about 15 different environmental and species characteristics that would actually be helpful in predicting whether a species would go extinct would evolve. Now, based on our model, with our numbers we came up with, and they were, to be fair, simply educated guesses. But based on our numbers, we would predict that we would see the appearance of a brand new bacterial species on the average of once every year. And so we felt this is a way to test our model. Are we seeing new bacterial species showing up? And, you know, how long have we had the capacity to see these things? Well, for 150 years. In the past 150 years, we have seen no new bacterial species. New breeds, but no new species. So that assured us that our numbers were conservative, that in fact it was worse than what we had come up with from a natural evolutionary perspective. Now, on that basis, we look at your problem of the bipedal primates. All of them have body sizes much larger than 1 centimeter. All of them have populations way below 1 quadrillion individuals, and all of them have generation times much longer than 3 months. So on that basis, you would predict for all the primates a zero probability of evolutionary advance and a high probability of rapid extinction. And I think that explains why we see so many separate bipedal primate species over the past 6.5 million years, because their extinction times are so rapid. And in our model, God replaces the species that go extinct with new species. Now recently, and this will be coming up in our book on Who is Adam, released in September, and some of it is in this book, The Genesis Question, is in the case of Neanderthals and human beings, we can actually measure the rate of evolutionary advance thanks to the recovery of Y chromosomes and mitochondrial DNA. And what it shows for the human species is no significant change in the DNA over the past 40,000 years. And the case of Neanderthals, no significant change from 150,000 years ago to 38,000 years ago. And then when you compare Neanderthal DNA to human DNA, it's radically different. The 8 sites where we humans vary in the mitochondrial DNA, where you're comparing the two relevant segments, do not overlap in any place with the 25 sites where mitochondrial DNA vary. Therefore, Neanderthals could not possibly be the ancestor of human beings. And that means you now have to jump to Homo erectus. And with Homo erectus, you're looking at morphological features that are really radically different than, say, Neanderthal compared to humans.
Can I jump in with a biological? Sure. So this deals directly with what I did with my PhD, so I hope I'm on safe ground here. There are a lot of people looking at evolutionary mechanisms, and I was looking at one of them, although it was with a medical basis. We were interested in how genetic rare, supposedly rare genetic disease pops up. And we're looking at a mechanism by which you have a pool of variation. This isn't a new idea, but you have a pool of variation in a population, and then a mechanism by which this variation is released upon environmental pressure, say a toxin in the environment or extreme heat or something like this. And there are other people working on a field called epigenetics, which I'm going to define it as inherited things that have nothing to do with mutations. So there's a very famous study where people are looking at women who've gone through a period of starvation during pregnancy. Now their babies have a low birth weight, which is not surprising. But what was surprising was that those children then went on, well, the girls anyway, went on to have babies of low birth weight, although their diet was normal. And it took several generations for birth weight to pick up. And I assume that they controlled for diet and external circumstances. So, and this is quite a widely accepted study, so this got people thinking, man, there are inherited things that aren't just to do with DNA, and these are to do with the way that proteins fold up DNA within the chromosomes. And if DNA is folded up in a certain way, then the child that is born from this chromosome that contains this chromosome has inherited a gene that is not functional in a certain way. So this is something, it's called imprinting. So this is something that can be inherited. There's nothing to do with DNA. So my argument is that this is possibly another mechanism we need to consider in evolution, is that there are lots and lots of different epigenetics.
When you say through the DNA, Ruth, you mean through the sequence?
No, I mean this is changes in the DNA that is to do with the way the DNA is wrapped up by proteins.
Rather than sequential
changes. DNA doesn't exist on its own. It is coated with thousands of proteins.
Okay.
And these are very, very important. And there's a lot of research done on the way that we look at the cell in between. We've all seen the pictures of cell division with like little X's, and then they all turn into spaghetti in the middle. It's not spaghetti. It has very specific locations and interactions between the regions in the genome. And these interactions and things, there's an awful lot we don't know about DNA and cell biology.
So you're ruling out, you're able to rule out a gene change, a gene mutation in that?
The
folding structure.
Specific examples of changes that are inherited that are nothing to do with mutation, yes.
Mutations of genes.
Yes.
And you're really able to rule that out for the entire genome.
There are lots of cases.
I know, but...
imprinting as a...
Yeah. Tell
as
me
a mechanism is a well-accepted...
I'll ask this question privately later. I'll ask the question privately later.
One question I can ask is, some of my reading indicates that there's a lot of discussion that this imprinting may not be permanent, that you get a sinusoidal function in response to the environmental stress.
Yeah. So what we're doing is we're moving away from a gene-only hypothesis of inheritance. Yeah. But the environment, I'm not talking about the external environment now, I'm talking about the developmental environment in an individual's body, is now different. So they're making leading the way for different mutations to interact. I mean, everything interacts in very complex networks and pathways.
Somehow, I think it is a very big question. What does it mean, this discontinuity or the miracles and so on? And I think it would be nice if we can somehow ask our panel members to describe what they understand under the miracles, under this discontinuity and so on. Because for me, all of them somehow, miracles and this there are some kind of they destroy about the law of nature, in a sense. Not destroy in the sense general, but stop it or somehow. Like when Moses put his hand up, the sun stopped. Okay, I don't know whether we can see it in the stars, but somehow something happened.
I want to see if Ruth would like
well,
to
Well, before I talk about miracles, I just want to clarify my position here. I'm not saying we will never find any discontinuity in biology. I can't say that. We're always working on a hypothesis. But I'm not sure biology's there yet. I think there's too many uncharted waters, and we work by imagination and lateral thinking, and incredible surprises happen every day in biology. That's the position I'm coming from. I'm sure somebody else can do a much better job than me talking about miracles, and they happen.
Well, in terms of
Jesus rose from the dead, and that's very important, and it's important to take the Bible seriously on these matters.
In terms of miracles, the Bible talks about three different kinds. You've got what are called the sustaining miracles that we see described in Colossians 1, how the very fact that the universe holds together is a miracle. God is holding it all together. And this is typically what scientists are studying when they look at the record of nature. They're looking at the sustaining miracles and figuring out how amazingly it is that everything fits together and holds together. That's a lot of what the fine-tuning's about. But a different kind of miracle is described in the Bible is what I would call an intervention miracle. And I think this is what this guy will be speaking about in his seminar, how we have God intervening in the record of nature, but without violating the laws of physics. What he does is he intervenes and manipulates the physics to get the miraculous result he desires. And most of the miracles we see described in the Old Testament historical events fit into that category. You know, God will come down and perform great miracles on behalf of the Jews, but he does it without violating the laws of physics. But it's something that if the laws of physics were to run on their own, would not happen. It can only be explained by God miraculously intervening to work with the physical material to bring about his designed result. I mean, a good example of that would be the story in Judges, where we have Ruth and Barak on top of Mount Tabor, and we have the army of Sisera, the enemies of the Israelites, at the base of Mount Tabor. And what we hear in the text is a torrential rainstorm fell at the base of the mountain, but it was dry on top. And then when things got thoroughly chaotic for the army of Sisera, this is when God gave the command and Barak and Deborah came down and won a great victory. Well, if you've ever visited the Valley of Jezreel, it's a very large, flat valley with this single mountain smack in the middle. And the way meteorology operates in that area is you always get a lot more rain, factor of 10 times as much rain at the top than you do the bottom. This is the reverse. It's something you would not expect if physics was just operating outside of God's miraculous intervention. Then there's category three. Category three is where God supernaturally intervenes from beyond the laws of physics. For example, we have the axe head floating to the top of the water in the story of Elijah. Physics can't explain that. That's God literally violating the laws of physics to bring about his desired result. Jesus walking on water, the creation of the universe. I would argue the creation of life is in that category. Okay, the creation of the spirit of man, where we see the great baras in Genesis 1. Those are all transcendent miracles. Now, I think what's interesting, as you look at Scripture and the scientific record, which miracles predominate? Well, vastly, it's the sustaining miracles. And then there are some intervention miracles, and there's only a few transcendent miracles.
Thank you very much, panel.
Yeah, thank you.